This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Today's guest, Major League closer and Rookie of the Year, Greg Olson, the son of a very good friend of mine, Bill Olson. Greg, one of the most dominant closers with 217 career saves. And I believe if he wasn't injured, he'd be in the Hall of Fame. Hello, everybody. I'm Pete Caliendo, your host. And you're listening to Baseball Outside the Box, episode number 50. Thank you. What an incredible accomplishment. Never thought we'd be here. Thanks for all our listeners for being with us. That's what allowed us to get to episode 50. And remember, this is the podcast where we interview the best coaching minds in the game who love the challenge, the status quo. I'd like to welcome all our listeners in the U.S. and around the world. We appreciate listening to the show. Special thanks to our producer with the Lineup Media Group, Brian Kroc. If you love listening to different podcasts, then you'd love to check out the fastest growing podcast company around, lineupmediagroup.fm. Our guest, Greg Olson, one of the best closers in the game, with a girl named Uncle Charlie, is on Twitter. He's at Greg Olson 30, G-R-E-G-G, Olson, O-L-S-O-N, the number 30. And he is not afraid to speak his mind. That's why we love him. We love to have him on the show. Don't forget, I'm on Twitter at Baseball Out. We've got a lot of great information for you on Twitter, so check it out. Greg is also on Facebook at Greg Olson, and check out us on Facebook, Baseball Outside the Box. We've got a lot of great fundamental videos on there for you. Check it out. Now, Greg's an author of the book called We Gotta Play Baseball, 60 Stories from Men Who Played the Game, as well as an entrepreneur, businessman, as part owner and president of Toolshed Sports Performance Gear. Go to toolshedusa.com. All right, let me welcome our good friend, Greg Olson. Greg, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Pete. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. And I've been trying to get you on the show, and you're very busy. And I've been traveling internationally, and it's so thrilling. I mean, it's a thrill to have you on the show, because I think it's going to be a great perspective from the standpoint, you know, you played at all levels. You played the collegiate level, you know, you obviously high school, college, youth ball. You went on with Team USA. You then signed a pro contract, became one of the best closers around. And I think you can give us a great perspective of, you know, teaching kids at a young level. But what I'd really love to start with is, you know, talking a little bit about you and your dad, because your dad, obviously, growing up with Bill Olson, who, you know, to me is like a mentor and just one of the best coaches around. I want to get your perspective, you know, the pressure of maybe growing up with your dad, or maybe lack of pressure, and there's just a lot of learning. What was that like for you when you were real young?
You know what? It was one of those where you really didn't know any different. He was my dad, and I don't think I recognized at the time how respected he was around. You know, I didn't have coaches coming up going, "No, you're so lucky," or I just saw it from, you know, coming through elementary school and going to watch his games and just, you know, loving to watch his players and then, you know, getting there as a freshman and trying to, you know, make my mark. Didn't really look at it that way, but, you know, once you leave and recognize the time and effort that we put in, you know, the work, fundamentals, you know, you recognize that he was really good at what he did.
Yeah. And I tell you what, I was fortunate to be on Team USA coaching staff with him as a young coach, and I learned so much from him. What's interesting is you growing up with him. Did he coach you when you were younger?
No.
All right. But you guys, obviously, he went to games, and I think this is a good perspective. I really want to get your take on, because there's a lot of issues out there with parents and even, you know, parents that are coaches who happen to go to games. I want to get your perspective on, you know, what your dad What was he like? Because obviously he came to your games, whether it was at youth baseball or whether it was at high school level. How was he at the ball games?
Oh, he never said a word. I think there was one tryout where they were going to have a, little league and just have a start throwing from the outfield without playing any catch. And I still never figured out what moron decided to do that. and that was the first time I really saw him step in and just kind of walk up to whoever was running the tryout going, they have to play catch.
Yeah.
And so that was the first time I remember him, actually stepping in. But every game, he just sat in the stands, watched on the ride home, would be a little bit of input, but nothing big, and he never said a word. So there wasn't anything. He was, I don't know how he did it because I when I go to games, I have to sit out in left field.
Yeah.
I can't. Well, I don't do it because you know what? I understand. Excuse me. I understand that the coaches, and this is going to sound badly and egotistical, but the coaches don't know as much as I do.
Right.
So I completely understand that. And any prep work should have been done by the coach or me. So whatever happens in the game, I don't care. I got to sit out in left field because I can't see what the umpires are doing behind the plate.
Sure. You know what? And I get it.
I don't want to be close enough.
Yeah, Greg, and I get it. You know why? Because, you brought up a couple good points. One, as coaches, even as volunteers, and your dad and I have been working with a lot of volunteers in our career trying to really help coaches get better. But as volunteers, you know what? They've got to understand certain things. And one thing you brought up is, you can't allow kids to play catch without getting warmed up. So, I can see him stepping in that purpose because you're talking about possible injuries there if that continues. And the second part, and I agree with you 100%, if the coaches aren't educated, just because you're a volunteer, that's not an excuse. You still should be educated the best you can, do your best job you could just to help these kids out. That's why I wanted to bring up the perspective of your dad, because, keeping quiet is extremely hard. And before we get to that, I want to delve in a little bit also into, because we're going to get to the part about games. I want to get into a little bit about when you were with him at home. Were there times where you guys obviously worked on pitching? If there were, what were some of the things that he encouraged you as a young player when you did work on pitching together?
You know what? We spent a lot of time in the backyard. And he was a former catcher in the Yankees organization. So he would get down in a catcher's spot no matter, I don't know what his rhythm or his routine was, but he would come home from school and it would be, he'd whistle me home, and no matter if I was playing baseball with my friends or football or, we were always doing something sports, he'd whistle me home and I would throw to him. Hmm. And he was more work, we always just worked on balance. I remember one year, I think Steve Busby had the hands breaking out over the knee. So, he had me trying that. But it was mainly just balance and repetitions was what we did. And then when I became, when I turned 13, we started spinning breaking balls.
Now, another point you brought up was, I thought it was very interesting because we talk about this all over the world where we go, the ride home. I thought that was interesting. You said, I'm sure your dad was, not only youth baseball, but also high school. You guys had to go home together. What was he like when you had a bad day or vice versa, when you had a great day? Because I think that, he did a lot of great things right. And I want the audience to understand that.
You know what? The only time that he got mad and the only time that I get mad with my kids is, for me, effort level and body language. And I wasn't a bad body language guy. I was really a bad loser. So, post games for me, if I lost the game on the mound or my team lost, I wasn't very happy and I was storming around and And most of our conversations were based on, you know, body language. And I, you know what, once I got to the big leagues and kind of got that perspective from the Ripkins, I can't criticize somebody's play.
Mm-hmm.
And I never do. I'll never criticize your judgment on what you were trying to do on this play, whether I think it's ridiculous or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making the effort to make that play, I cannot, in my mind, judge you. But I can judge your effort level. And if I don't feel like my son or some of the kids on the team that I might, you know, I've been helping with my son's teams and little once, never do it again, but I'm always there at practice. I'll be there at the game. And I'll get on somebody about effort level. I won't get on their decision on, you know, throwing the ball to shortstop when they had a chance to throw somebody out of the plate.
Sure.
Because that's my fault, you know. So our conversations were more based on, you know, getting better at my post-game attitude. You know, effort level, I was always a high effort. And so we might run through what my judgments on some plays were or some pitches, if, you know, and he had every right to get in the car and ask me that. You know, and I do that to my kids. But if I ever had a manager question one of my pitches, in hindsight, it didn't go very well.
Okay. Now, that's interesting, because I want to get into your son, because I know you have a son playing now. You referenced him a couple times. Before I do that, I've got to ask this question, because it's a big topic, and I've seen you on Twitter, in other social medias, and you, as a player, I've seen you play, and I still remember the strikeouts with Oakland, three of the top hitters in a row, and I remember that nasty curveball. I'll never forget it. You know, it was rated one of the top four curveballs in the big leagues. And we're talking about guys like Blylevin, you know, compared to, you know, Blylevin's curveball. But, you know, you started throwing that curveball at what age? And I know later on you had some injuries. Do you think that was a reflection of the curveball, or was it other areas that maybe caused that injury?
Pete, how long do you got?
Well, it's an important topic, you know, and I want our, you know, I want our audience, because it's a hot topic in baseball in general, you know, injuries that are happening in pitchers. You know, they don't happen when you're just in the big leagues. Obviously, they've got to, you know, start happening a little bit earlier. And love to get your perspective, because you've been through it, and also the rehab behind it.
All right. So I started spinning breaking balls at the age of 13.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't allowed to throw one in a game. And the curveball that I threw was the traditional, you know, hand closed at the top of release. No wrist. I wasn't spinning it with my wrist.
Mm-hmm.
I was creating the spin with the traditional karate chop into the stomach. You know, a short arm arc in front. My father taped two baseballs together, and you could see the spin. If you were doing it correctly, the spin was coming off the fingers correctly, or a tennis can. So the way that I was taught to throw it was correct. But knowing that, and I'm teaching my, now he's 15 and it's a constant. It's not a high velocity pitch. It's a, you're beating the hitter with, you know, depth and a little bit of speed. You can change speeds on it. You're beating the hitter on the depth of the break. So the way I was taught by my father was correct. I got to third year in the big league, and in my aspect of life, I had a horrible year with a 3.1 ERA. And the Orioles thought that I needed to get a better slide step and a concept of, you know, the running game. And I just looked at it going, you know, they were overreacting to the fact that, you know, I had one of those years that every bat that I broke, it fell over shortstop for a base hit, and the one guy that I walked that inning scored. because he stole second base. And so I didn't have a great year. So I went down to instructional league at the end of 91. This is after my third year in the big league.
Mm-hmm.
And the pitching coach wanted me to get a little bit quicker to home plate. So we started tinkering with my leg kick, the drop and drive that I was known for. I was a big drop and drive guy. And my breaking ball had come off of that, where I started to figure out that I could throw it almost 80 miles an hour and create more tilt by shortening my stride from the drop and drive. Trying to keep the long story remotely short, went down to instructional league, and in order to get a decent slide step, he wanted me to change leg kick and become a tall and fall. Well, my breaking ball then went to 84, 85 miles an hour, and much shorter, more of a slider, more of a throw and turn breaking ball. And that, within a year, I went to Japan for an all-star thing after the season, hurt my elbow there, came back, and then the next season I completely blew out in July.
Wow.
So firmly believe that the throw and turn breaking ball was what devastated my elbow and not the traditional curveball.
Sure. Craig, here's an interesting area I want to discuss, because I know you're coaching with your son, and you're actually going to the games. Sometimes you might be working with him at home. Give us a perspective, for our audience around the world, what it's like. Because it's a lot of pressure, obviously, for a parent that's a coach to sit at a game and watch your son play, especially if they're not doing well or if something happens. How do you deal with that? Also, the ride home, I think that's important. Discuss that a little bit.
I go to the game. If it's a high school game where it's playing for an end game, for high school or college, there's a goal. Yeah, and what bothers me about travel ball is I don't feel like there's an end game other than getting somebody recruited.
Mm-hmm.
So the high school games, I go out into left field because I don't want to see the umpire's strike zone. If my son's pitching or hitting, I don't want to be in I don't want to be able to say anything out loud.
Sure.
So go out to left field, watch the game. Travel ball, I'll sit behind and just be a parent and not care what the results are, just watch the game. On the ride home, we'll talk about, what plays he made, what plays he didn't, why didn't he. When he's pitching, trying to encourage him to, because he throws hard and he's, just stuck in the mode of pumping fastballs. I try to talk him into, hey, this would have been a good time to spin a breaking ball. It's time to start, advancing that a little bit, or this would have been a great pitch for a changeup. And then hitting wise, try not to critique his swing in game ever. And then, on the ride home, hey, what were you looking for here? How can we do a little bit better job of, staying back, or I'm just trying to be positive because the game is so hard.
Sure.
And it, the hard part for me is as a parent listening to the Little League parents go, get your back elbow up, get closer to the plate. Yeah. It's just like, you get in the box. Let me throw to you.
Yeah. See how easy it is.
See how comfortable you are.
Yeah.
This little kid's 8 years old. He's terrified of getting hit by the ball. And you're screaming at him. I was like, I'll tell you what, let's just play a new game. I'll back up about 10 feet from where they're pitching and I'll start throwing. See how comfortable you get.
You know what, Greg? No. I'm with you on that. And, that's why, again, I'm going to reference, it's so important, the education. Sometimes we tend to forget things. We educate our coaches, at least we try to, but we forget that we need to educate our parents too, because parents just don't know. And if they're not explained the process, why it's so difficult and shown, you know, it's very hard for him. So I get it. That's why I think having a show like this is important, and listening to what you have to say, because you've gone through it with your dad, and you've also gone through it now with your son, and you really understand it well. When somebody like you says, you know, hey, I just sit there and watch the game, that means a lot, and parents need to really listen to that, because it is so much pressure these kids have on them. Now, interesting, you said that ride home. I think that's important too. When you sit now, do you offer the information right away, or does he ask you? Does your son ask you questions? How does that happen?
You know what? For the most part, I'll offer. If it was a bad day, I'm encouraging. You know. I love my dad. I don't know how encouraging. I don't remember positive or negative. So take that as a neutral. I really don't remember, you know, car ride home about bad game. I really don't. I remember car ride home after I was an idiot, you know, where I let my temper get the best of me, or, you know, something like that. I remember those, but I don't remember positive or negative, but I, you know, when I played and when I pitched, the bad days were monumental. And, you know, my wife is still upset from, you know, 25, 30 years ago when I pitched. If I blew a game, I didn't talk to anybody. I couldn't even express my disappointment level. I couldn't even get into it. You know, everything was just, it was awful. And so when my kids have bad games, I try to be positive. I try to listen to what they're saying about, you know, what they feel, what went wrong. And really, I on the bad days, I don't critique until they ask. And then I might give my input on what I think went wrong. On the good days, I'm sunshine and puppy dogs. You know, everything was great. You know, you did this, you did this. I love that. And, you know, I might, at the end of the night, slip in something. Hey, you know what? We can work on this a little bit. So that's my car ride home. You know, if the effort's not there and they have a bad day, then I have a problem.
Sure.
Because the only thing you can control is your effort.
Sure. Very, very important points, boy. And something that was interesting, you know, when you're talking about, because you brought up the pitching aspect, and you talked about a lot of the mental aspect, that sounded like, you know, pitch selection, you know, what type of pitch. When you were a closer, obviously you guys had a lot of reports. Relate this to when you were a closer and also working with your son and understanding all this. How did you determine what you were going to pitch? Was it according to the hitter's weaknesses? Was it according to your strengths? Was it a combination of both?
That's a really great question, and I, you know what? For me, I became a big sequence guy after I got hurt. I had to really watch, you know, how he took that pitch. What is our, you know, I was always big on my past history with everybody. So I wish I would have patented it, because it's called BATS now, and it almost looks identical to my page that I kept starting in 1989, where I, you know, had a computer page and made a printout, and I had every at bat versus every hitter that I'd ever faced, because I wanted to know how I was starting a guy, you know, how did I get to the point where I could throw, you know, strike him out. And that was, you know, that was what I wanted to know. I wanted to know how to start, how to finish, and everything else in between was leading up to how to finish. So when I was out on the mound, yeah, there's a little bit of weakness involved. And then there's a little bit of, you know, my strength on his strength involved. It was just literally, what's the right pitch? What's he doing? You know, what's my what, you know, what's been my success with this pitch, you know, because if a guy's weakness is a fastball away and I'm on the third base side of the rubber and I'm not real strong on that side of the plate, then it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for me to try to throw this pitch, you know?
Right.
So I'm not a big weakness on weakness. I'd rather go strength on strength.
Okay. And now, were you always a closer, and the mentality of a closer, you developed that? Did you have it already? What kind of mentality does a closer have?
I became a closer my sophomore year in college. It was starting, I don't know if it was even starting. I was probably one of the first ones. I couldn't sit back every 5 days. I was an everyday player all through high school. Went to Auburn as a first base pitcher. This Frank Thomas guy kicked me out of first base.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Going into my sophomore year, Hal Baird, my college coach, and I kind of sat down, and I would go nuts in the middle of the week. So we tried it out in the fall. I could pitch back to back, no problem. That part of it was easy, and my mentality was in this politically correct world, just everybody just take, this is my mentality when I pitched. I wanted to kill everybody. I wanted to absolutely and utterly crush your spirit. And I was going to do that every pitch, every at bat. I was going to crush your spirit. So the next time you saw me, you did not want to play with me. And that was my mentality. Every time I went out on the mound, every pitch had an end game of, you're never going to want to face me again. And so, it was, for me, it was, man on man, kill or be killed. I have to win.
Sure.
But go ahead.
No, I was going to say that mentality, obviously, you know, plays into the next game, you know, next time you see him, but also, What about if somebody beat you and maybe you gave up a home run? How did you deal with that, since you were so tough on yourself?
Most of the time it was really my fault. I rarely gave credit. Somebody had to do something pretty special for me to give credit to the hitter. Otherwise, again, sequencing. And it took me a while to come to this conclusion where it lessened a little bit of the blow. I firmly believe that if I make a bad pitch, it didn't matter what, I can't look and see that the pitch was wrong, because I didn't execute. But if I make a great pitch and a guy hits it hard, then it was the wrong pitch.
Interesting.
So then I go back into the sequence of what happened and how did he get to the point where I led him to what I thought was the right pitch. So I rarely gave hitters credit, because if I made the bad pitch, I made a bad pitch. If I made a great pitch and they hit it hard, then I didn't make the right pitch.
Interesting. Love to hear.
It doesn't leave much of a window for me to give credit to a hitter.
Sure. No, I love to hear that, because you got a lot of confidence, obviously, in it. Now, in season, I'd like for our coaches to know this. What was your routine in season? Obviously, you close, so you had to pitch, two, three times a week. But what kind of routine did you have to kind of get your body back in gear?
I would lift after I pitched. I would lift a little bit, depending on how much I had been lifting. I didn't, if I'd been lifting like in spring training, you're lifting a lot coming off the off season where you've been lifting all the time. Then if I'd been lifting pretty steadily, then I would lift appropriately after a game. I wouldn't push myself where I might get stiff and sore for the next day. and then always ice, which apparently I'm finding out isn't right. But if I didn't ice, I was a little stiffer, a little crankier. And then next day, I every day I went to the ballpark, I was prepared to pitch. So I ate well before the game, I rested, took care of my body. During the day, I might get on a treadmill for 15 minutes or an elliptical or something just to, try to stay in shape. But everything was the crux of everything I did was preparing to be ready for that night's game.
All right. Now, were there ever times where you had time that you could work on a pitch or work on your movements, something that you thought maybe you were off sync and you can find some time to do that?
I had pitching coaches that liked to throw, a light, they call it a light bullpen,
Right.
But during batting practice, where I can get a little bit, Kansas City, when I went there, was big on, me getting on the mound a little bit and spinning breaking balls because it was such a feel pitch. For me, it was probably a 50% over my career for ball strikes. So Kansas City would have me, get on the mound and spin breaking balls for 15 or 20 pitches, and then I'd be fine that night. And more to working on, so that would be working on the breaking ball. Really, if I hadn't thrown in 3 days, I might do a 5-minute light bullpen during batting practice just to find my feel for sides of the plate, breaking ball again. I just call it a touch up, but I had worked hard enough on my pitches that I didn't just lose them. Something, when my breaking ball would go dark one night, it would be because something I was doing with my body. So watch a little bit of film, come back the next day, throw a light bullpen, try to clean up what I was doing mechanically.
That's interesting. When your curveball wasn't working, or a certain pitch wasn't working, did you force it? Did you try to still throw it, or did you just stay with the other pitches you had?
Well, I firmly attributed that to my walks per inning. I forced it. I knew I had to find it.
Interesting.
And there was rarely days where, not rarely, 50% of the time I walked out. And first good curveball I threw was for a strike. And then it's like, okay, I don't have to spend time finding it. The other 50% of the time it was, here's fastball strike one. Here's two breaking balls. Here's another fastball. Get back into it. Here's another breaking ball. And I might walk a guy. And it was just for the intent, the idea that, all right, I got 3 or 4 breaking balls there in that at bat. And now I got a better idea on the second hitter. And then by the end of the inning, I usually had a pretty good concept. I wasn't really afraid that, the hitters are going to go, oh, he's not throwing it for a strike, because I don't think they recognize that, I had days where I could probably go the whole inning without throwing a curveball for a strike.
And on top of it, the hitter had to be worried about your fastball, because that was 94 plus.
Yeah. No, he did, and that was enough to defend my curveball when it was off. It was kind of comical, because my reputation with my breaking ball, again, sounds egotistical, but my reputation with my breaking ball forced guys to look for it, and so I would get swinging strikes out of the zone more often than I did in the zone. And then, every 0-2 count was a curveball on top of home plate that a lot of guys went after. And then once I got hurt and my curveball wasn't, you know, the thing that I could just go, here comes three curveballs, I don't care if you're looking for them. After I got hurt, it wasn't that out pitch anymore, but my reputation was still the same.
Sure.
So 90%+ of my strikeouts after I got hurt were fastballs 0-2, 1-2 that I just threw hard, caught a piece of the plate, and the hitter was vapor locked, which couldn't pull the trigger because I knew he was looking for a breaking ball.
Greg, on this show, we've got a lot of coaches that listen, not only in the U.S., but around the world. And it is a show to help coaches, players, and parents and educate them more. One area I want to talk about, and I know it could be a book, and I know you've got a lot of input on this. I want to reach to the most important areas on this. Advice for our coaches. When you go to games and you watch coaches, I know they do a lot of good things also, but I really want to tackle the areas that you feel coaches need to work on a little bit more and why they need to work on these areas.
Okay, can you say that again?
You know, things that coaches at games or in practices need to work more and getting better. Because, you know, you see a lot of games and, you know, there's a lot of things that coaches do well, but there's also a lot of things that coaches like myself don't do so well. What are some of the areas that you feel coaches need to improve in the majority of the games that you watch out there?
You know what? That's really tough to say. I think it's largely an individual thing. I don't sit there and judge the coaches on what they do well, what they don't do well. I'm not a big fan of calling pitches because, you know, if the hitter doesn't like that pitch, it's not going to have a good result.
So you have the players, you have your catchers and pitchers get together and call pitches?
Yeah, because they're going to need to, you know, I guess, you know, high school they call pitches, college they call pitches. So they get to the minor league, they have zero concept of what they're looking at.
Yeah, you know, and Greg, I agree with you, and I'll tell you why, and I think this could lead into a good topic. And I agree with you because I think the younger they are, they need to start learning that on their own a little bit. That way, when they get to a certain level, at least they've got an idea. Otherwise, we're just robots.
I absolutely agree. I don't really like it. And the catcher needs to learn what he's seeing from the hitter. Pitcher needs to learn, you know, what's working. And I've told my kids, I was like, look, if it's a medium to big situation and you aren't sure what's the right pitch, then look at me.
Yeah.
And I'll give you what I got.
Absolutely.
But for the most part, you know what? I'm watching the outfield. I'm, you know, positioning guys in the field. And I'd rather be doing that and watching guys and how they're reacting to pitches than sitting there calling every pitch. You know what? I don't go watch practice as much. And I think, you know, the coaches do all their work in practice. And then once the game starts, it's game on and you're coaching when they come to the side. Hey, you know what? I need you to do this or I need you to do that. But everything that happens in the game, you know, whether it be a fault or a flaw in your bunt defense, that goes back to the coach didn't prepare these kids well enough. And that's one thing my father's preached on has been, you know what, if we screw this up in the game, this bunt defense or this hit and run, that's my fault because we obviously didn't prepare well enough.
Yeah, I tell you what, that is great advice. And I remember your dad, boy, you know, because I've been with him in practices and, you know, he was firm. He was great. He was really good in practices. And then it came game time, you know, it was time to play. And then, you know, and he took onus on if something went wrong. And I think coaches, that's what I like about the show when you bring something like that up. Now, I got to ask Greg Olson, because it's a hot topic, what's your advice on pitch counts?
You know what? I think that's kind of part of the problem with the younger kids. I like, you know, we put in rules out here because the younger kids were, you know, the little league rules were 85, you know, it was an 85 pitch count. And I just kind of looked, you know, I'm on the board out here in Southern California for Little League. And I just said, well, you realize that our little Johnny just threw more pitches than Roy Halladay just did in spring training, right?
Yep.
Everybody's kind of looks at me. I'm going, well, our games start 1st of March. Spring training starts 1st of March. The spring training starting pitchers are on 30 pitches, 35 pitches, their first outing. And Little League has 85 pitches. And who do you think would be in better throwing shape? Yeah. Well, we need to, you know, so we put in before April 1st, nobody can throw more than 50. Because they're not in shape. Now, the high school kids, okay, let's elevate it a little bit, but they're still not in throwing shape. So I think, you know, you start your bullpens, let's say January 1st, and you do a 25, 30 pitch bullpen, and you do another one. Let's go to 30, 35. And then wherever you got built up to, you know, I'd probably shorten it a little bit for the first game, and then try to stay around there and building forward. But it's, you know, it's more on what these kids have done in bullpens than, you know, me giving a blanket number and where they're at, you know?
Yeah. No, great advice. Love to hear that. And we are coming to not total end. We got about 5 more minutes. I want to address this because, you know, I've been very lucky as a national team coach. And being involved in international baseball, you were on a very special team in 1987. I believe the Team USA, that when you beat Cuba in the 33, they had a 33 game winning streak at that time. Give our audience an idea of what it's like to represent your country on that particular team, and you know what you got out of it going on to your pro career.
I was lucky enough to be on the 87 team. I was on an 84 junior team. And then I had to leave the Olympic team in 88 because I was sick.
Right.
You never listen. The national anthem has never been the same. You know, when you play, you know, you're playing Cuba. We went down to Cuba and you've been down there. We went down there for 12 days, played 7 games. And, I mean, it was an atmosphere I've never seen. These guys, you know, I remember coming in to pitch in a game, and I'm 20, and I'm facing a guy that comes in to pinch hit against me at 38.
That prepared you for the big...
I'm literally going, well, I should be able to throw fastballs by him, and, you know, my break going to be, this guy's done. You know, 38, come on.
Yeah.
And he had a ball right back in my forehead. I was like, okay, mental note. Got me. Cuba was intimidating because they were, I guess it was like facing Russia in the 80s in hockey. Mm-hmm. They were so well prepared, and they were so good. They didn't beat themselves. You had to beat them. And so, I mean, we had guys, Tino Martinez and Jim Abbott. The 88 team had Ben McDonald and Andy Benes and Robin Ventura. We had great soon-to-be major league players. It was just, you go out and it was a dogfight with those guys, you know. And if somebody came in and wasn't on their game, we lost.
You know, and I got to ask you this because – you know, and nothing to do with the 88, but in 88, I know you weren't there because you were sick. I was actually in Parma, Italy for the final game when Abbott pitched the final game and was winning 3-0 in the 9th. But I got to ask you, you know, the competition, because of older guys, you know, you played against Kinderlin, Pacheco, Linares. I remember all those guys. What's your advice for parents and coaches with kids that are dominant at a certain age? Because we seem to put kids in age groups now of like 14 only, 13 only, 12 only. But what happens if you got a kid that's dominating or vice versa? What's your advice? Should that kid be playing up? Because that was, you know, you were playing up against some of these guys that were 38 and was a great experience, obviously.
I don't have a problem. I hate to see kids go up a level and they're not prepared.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of homework. I mean, my 14-year-old was playing with the 16U team last summer.
Yeah.
And yeah. he was fine. You know, it wasn't too much. So it's a little bit of homework. It's a little bit of, you know, hey, if I'm going to make this move with my kid, then I need to be prepared and go watch a game or two.
Good point.
Just to see what he's walking into. Because it's easy to assume, it's easy for parents to think that their son's the blessed child and, you know, he's dominating this level where, you know what, a little bit of size and a little bit smarter at the next level might not be the best move, and I hate kids going up and getting crushed.
Yeah, agree. You know,
bottom line is just do your homework.
Sure. Great advice. And, you know, and finally, you know, what I want to, the last question I wanted to ask, and then I'm going to leave it open to you, Greg. At the end, I'd like for you to just give some general advice to parents and coaches, anything you want to say to them. But the other part I just wanted to ask, because you've been generous with your time and I really appreciate it. When you went from college to pro ball and to the big leagues, what were the major adjustments that you had to make? What was the difference between the college and pro level and the pro minor league level and the big league level?
High school to college was a big jump because, you know, same, you take the best high school players are going on to the college. I played in the SEC, so you got kind of the best that are going on to college there. So there was an adjustment. I got my butt, you know, I went from undefeated through high school to having a 5.7 ERA my freshman year in college. And then there, you know, it becomes the game slows down a little bit. The next year I was fine to the minor leagues. And you know what? I don't know. I got to the minor leagues and I still had mono. So I didn't have, you know, my stuff. I didn't have, but I put it in perspective, you know, how good the college guys are the best of the high school, you know, looking around your neighborhood, there's one kid that will go on and play Division I in your little league.
Mm-hmm.
And then now let's take, you get to A ball and those are the best of the college guys that are going to A ball and, you know, rookie ball, A ball are the best of the college guys and the best of the high school guys. And then you get to double A and all of a sudden these three A ball teams are funneling to one double A team that not necessarily is going anywhere. The AAA guys are waiting on the major league guys to move. The AA guys are waiting on the AAA guys to move. And then you got three new teams of A-ball guys shoving up to AA. So you can imagine how much harder AA is than A-ball and start going incremental. And then the major leagues is just, you know, what it is. but it's difficult. So, you know, you said go for a minute, I would be just parent coaches. This game is really hard. It's really difficult. Hitters are successful. They fail 7 out of 10 times. You know, and to me, I learned this when I was about 33 years old. As a pitcher, if I can make the hitter not hit the ball hard, I've done something right. And the same thing for the hitter. If the hitter hits the ball hard, then he's done something right. And whatever happens after I release the pitch or after the hitter swings the bat, everything else is out of my control. All I can do is try to make the hitter not hit the ball hard. And as a hitter, all I'm trying to do is hit the ball hard somewhere. And that's it. It really becomes that simple because it's that difficult.
Hmm. All right, Greg. So, this has been did you want to add something else?
Nope, that's it. I was going to say that's about all it comes down to.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I'll tell you what, Got to thank you for your time. Thank you so much. Give your dad my best. I'm gonna have, I've had him on the show at the ABCA. I did a 15-minute segment with your dad, but I plan on having a full hour. I've seen you guys both on stage together. Outstanding job. You know, keep coaching because we need good coaches in the game. Hopefully you'll keep going and coaching baseball as long as you can, too.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate it.
All right, Greg. Again, Greg Olson, one of the top relievers in Major League Baseball, the all-time Baltimore Orioles reliever, 217 saves, one of the nastiest curveballs in the big leagues, and an outstanding fastball at 94-plus. And just a great guy. Check him out on Twitter. Don't forget, we'll have all that information on our show notes. So finally, thanks to everyone listening. You are the best. Without you, we would not be able to keep this show going. So thank you. Thanks to Brian Crock, our producer, and our special guest, Major League closer Greg Olson. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day, and we'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.